broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, everyone in the studio, and good morning to our listeners, and happy Friday.
Indeed.
Happy morning, Friday. Seth. Yeah, happy Friday.
Another week over.
Yes.
Almost. Wow. Got to get through today.
Yeah, we're close.
We're close.
Pretty close.
Yep. We're on the home stretch.
And you're going to the footy this weekend?
Yes, tonight.
Josh. We do, yeah. We're
looking to turn it around.
Collingwood, Richmond.
Mm. Yeah.
Sad. Never
big,
mind.
Not sad. Big game.
Big game. Could be season defining.
Yep.
Could be.
A lot on the line for
Louis,
both of us.
Do you think they're going to win?
Well, I was looking at the tipping on the AFL website, and out of 16 tipsters, 15 were picking Richmond.
Yeah. Mm. I wouldn't be surprised by that.
Yeah. But haven't Richmond been beating teams that are, you know, in the bottom half of the table?
Actually, I don't know. I hadn't really looked at
that. No, they beat GWS a couple of weeks ago.
But outside of that?
Only the easy beats, yep.
Yeah, okay. Oh, well, never know.
Collingwood beat what's in front of you.
Collingwood beat West Coast a couple of weeks ago.
Well, that's true.
And then lost some other games.
Yeah, well, we got smashed last week by GWS, but we'll just put that down as poor selection.
Yep.
Sounds like a Collingwood supporter.
Yeah.
Blame something else.
I can come up with lots more excuses.
What are you up to, Steph? Yeah. What are you up to this weekend?
Yeah.
Doing things that are not involving football. No.
Good for you.
Yeah, you haven't come to a game for a while, Steph.
No, I know. Look,
we're going to get you there this year?
No, I know. I'm happy to watch it on TV. I don't need to even see the repeat. Joel needs to go to the football and then watch it again.
You've got to do the post-game analysis.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's very important to give that feedback.
My wife doesn't understand that I'll be at the football and then I'll come home and I'll watch the highlights.
No, I don't get it either.
Yeah.
But look, whatever you do with your own time is your own time, I guess. All right. Well, we're going to kick off the first topic for today, and I'm going to throw over to Joel to kick us off. We're going to speak a little bit about Brexit.
Brexit.
And also Boris Johnson's...
And BJ.
Yeah. BJ. Did any of you guys get a chance to listen to his speech, his inaugural speech as Prime Minister?
I haven't done so yet, but I've heard it was good.
Got me fired up.
I think
I'd want to be a part of that Brexit after his speech.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What is his Brexit?
Well, it was just... it was very patriotic in some regards, but very firm and very staunch. Confidence building, I would say. Optimistic about the future, but also with a little bit of realism in there as well, saying, you know, yes, there will be pain, but, you know, we believe in this great country and this great country has a great future ahead of us and, you know, all of those sorts of, all of that sort of rhetoric, which was was quite stirring. It was about 11 minutes. You can download it on YouTube. It's the BBC, Boris Johnson's inaugural speech. Well worth a listen. And it got me sort of thinking, does anyone actually really know what's at stake here with Brexit? I mean...
I'm not fully understanding
No. So look, basically, the simple thing is this, right? We've got the European Union that was established after World War II. And then gradually it's become more of a trading bloc, an economic bloc, where if you are a part of that European Union, you have special trade rights with other countries within that union. You also have open borders where you can migrate from living in the UK to Poland to France without having any issues around movement.
Visas and passports.
But what it does mean is that you're subject to the rules of the European Union. And one of the biggest issues that I believe that the UK citizens have found is that while you get to vote for your political representatives in your own country, you don't necessarily get to vote for the political representatives in the European Union, in the Commission.
Mm.
And obviously, you know, people being people and politicians being politicians, a lot of people believe that there's a distrust there between what they actually vote for in their own country versus what actually gets decided at the European Union level. Those rules that are designed for trade and free commerce and free flow of borders can sometimes be very beneficial to stronger powers and perhaps a little bit more detrimental to weaker participants in the union. Obviously, France and Germany are a key constituents of that, considering that they were the first two to really bring this whole European Union together. And I think that many people from Britain have, over the years, have suggested that perhaps the association or the union with the UK has not delivered the outcomes that most European citizens perhaps would have liked. There was a lot of migration of Polish and Eastern European migrants into the UK taking manufacturing jobs. That created a bit of an upswell in many of the regional areas around the United Kingdom, and it's created some discontent, hence why they got to the point where they wanted to vote as to whether or not this was still in their best interest. Now, the key sticking points, though, at the moment. So, right now, Brexit is essentially a decision for the UK to leave that union and to go it alone. Now, what's on the table is that they can either try and negotiate a trade deal with the European Union, which will allow for a smoother exit from the EU. But Boris Johnson has come to power, and his his backers have brought him in as the Prime Minister of the Tories, largely because the deal that was negotiated by Theresa May was unacceptable. And the key points that were unacceptable really came around this backstop of the this backstop agreement, which is like an insurance agreement of Northern Ireland. So in the old days, or, you know, we all remember the Northern Ireland issues with the Protestants and the Catholics. There is a 310-mile border that separates Northern Ireland from Ireland. There is concern that, obviously, with Ireland being part of the EU and Northern Ireland being part of the UK, that if a Brexit happens, that you would create all of a sudden, you know, new checkpoints, new border controls, and that could be inflammatory to the situation in Northern Ireland. Now, the backstop deal is about making sure that Northern Ireland still retains much of the same sorts of trade agreements with the EU that the EU currently has, and that Northern Ireland doesn't become doesn't have the same type of exit that the UK does.
Right.
And Boris Johnson is supported by a faction of the Tories that is in Northern Ireland that don't want Northern Ireland to be left out of any Brexit deal.
God, it sounds complex to me.
Right, yeah. So what you've got here is a situation that Boris Johnson's come to power largely because of that power group in Northern Ireland that's saying, "Hey, don't forget us." But if the UK do forget them, then you know, that Boris Johnson is in there because of the representatives in Northern Ireland, and they don't want the UK to leave without them. But leaving and keeping the border open is troublesome, because then all of a sudden, how do you manage that border, and who has the control, and who's got the rights to manage that border in an environment where there's no consensus as to how that border should be managed.
Yeah. Mm. Well, you'd get on along to the chance, which is similar to another country, of build a wall.
And this is the whole issue. No one really wants the Northern Ireland and Ireland to go back to the days of, you know, the 80s and the 70s and the 60s.
No one wants it to be separated.
Is the tension still as bad now?
There are certainly simmering tensions there, but they're contained and controlled at the moment. Right. Now, what happens in the event? Now there are clear pathways that could be on the table for the UK. First of all, they negotiate and they accept the deal that Theresa May has negotiated with the EU, and they leave, with Northern Ireland essentially being left as part of the European Union. Now, it's supposed to be temporary, but there's no set date as to when Northern Ireland would then become part of the UK under the Brexit deal. And that's what's creating a lot of concern, that without a firm date there, that this could continue to go on forever and a day. They could reject the deal, and there is no deal, And under that set of circumstances, then the UK would then and the European Union would then trade under the World Trade Organization rules. Now, those World Trade Organization rules are much less favorable than any potential, you know, smooth exit from the union that has been negotiated at the moment. Now, the issue also has arisen that if they do have a hard Brexit, the issues around migration, what happens to the people who are in from the UK that are living in Europe at the moment, what happens to their status within those countries, what happens to people from that were from France and Germany and the Netherlands that are living in the UK, what happens to their status, what happens at the borders with trade, you know, what happens with lorries that are, you know, taking goods from over in France through the
Because it's not just a sea border. There is a road from France to the UK.
Yep, yep. What happens with medicines as well? So if the UK can't get access to key medicines that the European Union develop because trade doesn't allow that and there's all of a sudden huge customs controls, all of these things are huge unknowns. And the fear is that this could, you know, significantly disrupt trade between the UK and Europe to the point where the UK could find itself not just in an economic disruption, but also in a, you know, health and social disruption because of the lack of necessary goods to just function as a functioning society.
Yeah. Do you think they should have actually gone to a vote with Brexit, or they should have just left it as it was?
Oh, well, look, it was what the people wanted. They wanted to put it to a referendum. I mean, there wouldn't have been a referendum in the first place if there wasn't significant disharmony with how the UK felt about their relationship with the European Union at this point in time.
It seemed like the younger generation just didn't really think to even vote. It was just sort of more of an older generational thing that was driving that.
Well, I believe that is actually the case, that a lot of the younger generation didn't get out and vote. It was actually the older generation that were in the more working class areas that were very much pro-exit, pro-Brexit. Mm.
That's my bugbear about the situation. The referendum result was, I can't remember the number, but it was something like 51% to 49% or 52 to 48.
Yep.
But in reality, it was actually 34% for Brexit, 33% against Brexit, and 33% didn't vote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. You just got this huge amount of population that didn't turn up for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Well, sure, some of them
was going to happen.
Yeah, some of them were disengaged, but I would imagine that a lot of them just assumed the result was going to go a particular way.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to do another vote now to see where it actually lands, now that people really understand the magnitude. Do you think that will be something that will happen, or is it just going to stay with the government?
Well, so there is a third pathway that could happen, and that is that that Parliament in the UK push through a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson prior to the 31 October deadline. Mm. And what that does is strike a general election in the UK, which essentially would become a second referendum. So that could potentially be on the cards.
Sounds like a long path.
But let's be clear, Boris Johnson has made it very clear in his speech that come 31st of October, they're leaving. Through hell or high water, and he's not going to accept the current deal that is on the table, which would provide for Northern Ireland to be a separate, to be treated separately to the major island of the UK.
Undoing that's going to be really hard work.
Unscrambling one omelette to create another omelette.
Yeah.
Well, they might have to bring back that game show. Remember Deal or No Deal?
Yeah.
just make a television event of it.
That's right.
That's so true.
Look, it will be interesting to see how it plays out. I think you cannot deny that there's going to be some disruption in the short term. How long that goes on for, who knows?
Mm.
Right? But if you move forward, essentially what would happen beyond this is that the UK... over the next 3, 4, 5 years would be in a situation where they could negotiate trade deals, free trade deals, just like we do here in Australia with countries that we want to. And it may be that the UK doesn't do as much trade with Europe as what it currently does, and maybe it becomes closer to the US and Canada and Australia, and all of a sudden, you know, China and Russia and these other countries that that previously you hadn't done a lot of trade with because it was part of the EU.
Yeah, and a lot of emerging markets in Southeast Asia at the moment. And if we're taking a proper long view, which politics probably should, well, then you've got Africa and wherever they end up in 50 years, 100 years.
Yeah. So good chance that there's going to, if it is a hard Brexit, good chance that the UK is going to go through a fair amount of short-term pain. Medium to longer term, I'm not so certain that it needs to be so dire. Countries are going to want to still do deals with the UK. The UK, London, it's still a powerhouse. It's still a major financial centre. You know, it's still a key component of the global community. So,
so you think this will strengthen them if they actually leave?
I think there's a very good prospect of short-term pain for potentially longer-term gain, but you may not see those gains for another 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, right.
You know, you could find significant disruption in the next 5 years while the UK is trying to strike these free trade agreements, find new channels of trade and new supplies and new markets to for them to trade with and sell into as well.
Interesting time ahead.
Yeah.
Now, Joel, do you also touch on earnings seasons? I think you mentioned as well earlier.
Yeah, so it is earnings season coming up in the in the Australian stock market. Earnings start for ASX listed companies pretty much next week is the kickoff, and we've already got earnings in the United States have already kicked off as well. And I'd just like to sort of talk a little bit about a particular strategy that we're using at the moment, or that we will be using, I should say, in our hedge fund that we are looking to get off the ground later on this year. And it's around buying companies that meet all of your criteria, but you know that earnings announcements might pop up in the next 3, 4, 5, or 6 weeks. And now, we know traditionally that around earnings time and when a company releases earnings results, you can get some very volatile trading. And often what happens in the very short term on an earnings news announcement could be very different to what happens over the medium to longer term with that stock. So one of the strategies that we will be rolling out within our hedge fund is buying call options around earnings releases for stocks that we are looking to put into our portfolio. Now, what is a call option? A call option is the right to buy a stock, but not the obligation to buy a stock. Now, what that means is that if we, let's say we have, I don't know, Microsoft, let's say, and Microsoft's trading at around $40 a share, okay? And at some point in time in the next 3 or 4 weeks, Microsoft is due to release its profit announcement for the quarter, and we think that there might be a little bit of uncertainty as to how the market might accept that profit result, and we may be concerned that there could be a short-term sell-off, even though we're quite bullish on the stock longer term. We could either buy the stock at $40 today and wear that volatility if it does come, and we would suffer any sort of losses that might arise from that earnings announcement, or we could buy a call option, paying a very small premium, which gives us the right to buy the stock, but not the obligation to buy the stock. Now, if the share price does fall, then our maximum loss is just the premium that we've paid, which is usually about 1/10 of the cost of the stock. So we've got a defined level of capital that we are risking, which is significantly less than what we would be risking if we bought the whole position right before earnings. But if the share price does rise, and it rises significantly, then we can exercise our right to buy that stock at today's prices, even though the share price may have increased.
Right. Yep.
So just a nice little trick that we plan to roll out. It's another one of those useful strategies that that can be deployed and give you that advantage in the market that perhaps you might not ordinarily get access to if you're just an ordinary investor.
Yeah, so you get all of the profit potential, but your losses are limited.
Limited, absolutely.
So I've seen this similar with sometimes the car industry and even airlines do it, where you can lock in today's price and then choose to take it at a later date if you want to, or walk away. But you pay a fee to lock it in.
That's
basically
like
the same scenario.
Like a $5 fee or something to lock in your price
to lock in
today.
Today's price, and then you decide later if you want to accept that price.
Yeah.
So just with earnings season on the horizon, perhaps you've got your eye on a stock, perhaps you're a little bit nervous about buying too early, maybe consider doing some investigation on buying calls around this time.
Yeah, okay.
Good advice, Joel. All right, look, now we're going to throw to a very short break and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, and welcome back, guys. We're now going to throw over to Louis, who's going to continue with his series of Debt is Your Friend.
You're saying it wrong, Steph. Debt is your friend.
Creepy.
Yes. I've been talking about this for a few weeks and why debt and how debt helps people to do better with their finances. Mm-hmm. And in the weeks gone by, I've mentioned a few reasons already. The most obvious one for most people is, well, without debt, you couldn't buy a house to live in. Just about everyone, 99.9% of people get a home loan when they buy their first home, and it's just a necessary part of life a lot of the time. And what I said last week was that using borrowed money, using debt, is really a magnifier of your habits. If you have bad financial habits and you're spending more money than what you're earning, well, debt is going to magnify your problems. If you start spiraling into more and more credit card debt, personal loans, and increasing your bad debts at high interest. But if you have good financial habits, if you have a good savings plan and you are planning ahead and forecasting and strategizing with your finances, well, then debt is going to enhance those things. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to talk about today was, if you think that you want to use debt, well, then there's a couple of other things to put into your plan to make sure that it's right for you. Mm. So if you've listened to my past episodes on this and you're ready to go ahead, well, here's a couple of contingency plans that you need to think of. Because we don't just say, all right, you can borrow money, go out and do it. You can't do that because that's dangerous. So what do we look for when we're telling someone that they're in a position where they can use borrowed money to invest? Well, the first thing we're looking for is, does this person have surplus cash flow? Mm. Are they saving money on a regular basis? So if you are saving $100 per month on a regular basis, well, then you've got capacity to borrow a pretty small amount of money. If you've got $500 per month, then you've got a higher capacity to borrow money. If you're saving $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month or $5,000 a month, whatever it is, the higher your savings capacity, well, then the safer you are to go through this borrowing strategy.
Most definitely.
Yeah. Because if you're going to borrow, say, $100,000, well, the interest-only repayments might be $4,000 per year. Mm. So you need to afford that firstly. And you need a good buffer zone, because the second thing you need to do after you've confirmed that you've got surplus income is you need to plan for expected and unexpected changes.
Yep, very much so.
What do you think they might be?
Children.
Yes.
Children.
Illness.
Loss of job.
Illness, loss of job. And
death.
Death. And
increase in expenses.
Oh, it's obvious. It's just slipping through your mind, is all.
It's obvious.
Changes to interest rates.
Oh, interest rates, of course.
Interest rate changes. All right.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So,
it is,
my goodness.
It is early Friday. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Come on, guys. We do this every day.
Yeah, they've been so low for so long, we just didn't even think about it.
That won't happen.
No, it's because it's so obvious. You just assumed that it was in there. So the first thing is to plan around interest rate changes. Because, yeah, right now we can plan for interest rates to be 3.5% on certain types of borrowings, but you can't assume that that's going to be the case long term. So you need a buffer zone to allow for changes in that interest rate in future. Mm. Now, to do this, you can look at what future interest rates might be, and a good indicator of that is to compare the interest rate you can get at the moment with what would a five-year fixed interest rate be.
Okay.
So your five-year fixed interest rate is a pretty good indicator of what the banks think the five-year interest rates are going to be.
Mm.
But if you're going to have an investment strategy, you're going to have the debt for more than 5 years. You're going to have it for 10 years, maybe 20 years. So it would be good to have a certain amount planned anyway. So we typically use an interest rate of around 5% at the moment, at least for the first 5 years. And then we need to plan for what change might happen after that. Because beyond 5 years, we could have a reasonable expectation of interest rates being 6% or 7%. We just don't know. I'm not saying they will be, it's just that you need to have a plan in place.
Mm. Yep.
So if you're at a stage of career where you're getting pay increases, well, then maybe that's what's happening. Or if you are already reducing your personal debts and reducing your home loan repayments, well, then maybe in 5 years' time, the plan might be, well, my home loan payments could be lower after the next 5 years. Therefore, I can increase repayments to my investment debt. Whatever the plan is, have a plan around potential changes in interest rates. Mm. So you need a short-term buffer, and so banking on higher interest rates right now, so I use a 5% rate, not a 3.5% rate, if that's what's available, and then having a longer-term plan.
Yeah.
The other contingency would be around planning family changes. So yes, if you're planning on having children, or if you're planning on having holidays in future, or if you're planning on getting a new car in future, or other expenses, other changes to your circumstances. So what's your plan around those short-term changes to your situation?
Mm.
But also, the next thing is, what if something happens to your job, your earnings, the economy? Maybe it's the amount of overtime hours that you're getting with your employer right now. Could that not be the same in future and you get a decrease in your pay? If the economy changes, well, then how might your job be impacted?
Yeah.
If the economy changes and something happens to your employer, how secure is that? I'm not trying to tell you not to do it. What I'm trying to say is you need to have a plan in place if these things happen.
Mm. Like I'm planning to win the lottery.
So, how's that going for you?
Yeah. It's a plan. It hasn't executed yet.
Well, I know Joel had a plan a few weeks ago, which was to put $50 on a Collingwood win, and it actually worked that week.
That's a very
amazing.
Big rarity.
Yeah, it was a big call at the time. That's right. Yes. He didn't put $1 million on it, though.
No.
In hindsight, maybe you should.
I was going to ask you, Louis, how often do you think you should sort of revisit these kinds of plans? Is this like a once a yearly thing? What do you think?
Well, once you've got the strategy in place, you need to keep a lookout all the time for if your contingency plan is not going to work anymore.
Because you sort of, I personally sort of lose track. You sort of put a budget or a plan in place and then you kind of forget about it and the weeks keep rolling on and then you think, God, I've got to look at that budget, or I've got to think long term, and you forget to do it. So you know, I guess it's, you know, giving some advice on how to keep yourself accountable for it.
Great question. Yeah. What you're talking about is the habit.
Mm.
What habit do you have?
Yep.
Maybe I should come back to that later.
Not a good one.
But my short answer is that's why I hate budgets.
Mm.
Any financial article that says you can do all these great things if you just keep a budget, as soon as you say the word budget, what you're actually introducing is a half-day job to work out your budget to start with,
right,
and then a once-a-month job to review your budget on a regular basis, which is just a habit that most people don't have.
Mm-hmm.
If you have this habit, awesome. You're at a huge advantage if you have a budgeting habit, but I just know that most people don't.
No. Mm-hmm.
Which is why I talk about having a savings habit.
Yeah.
Forget monitoring your spending just because most people don't do it, and just start that savings habit. Right. And if you're just putting that money into your bank account as an automated savings plan, And if you've been saving $500 a month for the last 6 months, well, then you haven't done a budget. You haven't spent any time on it,
yeah.
But you can see the outcome. You've it's got simple. That regular savings. It's simple. It's easy to do. It doesn't take time. And you've proven to yourself that you've got that surplus regular savings capacity.
Yeah.
Nice.
So it's just sort of revisiting, though, when you do get an increase in your salary and going, okay, well, I have, you know, been
yes.
given...
Yes. So then you're looking out for when the changes happen.
Yeah. Okay.
So when a change in your pay happens, if it's a positive change, okay, what can I best do with this? Mm. Well, my pay increase is... $500 a month. Mm. After tax, it's $250 a month or whatever it is. I'm going to increase my savings plan by $150 a month, and then I'll keep $100 a month for my own fun and my own spending.
Yeah. Just curious, though, when you say don't have a budget, do you think that you initially need to have a budget so you sort of know where you're kind of at? Because if not, you're sort of just spending surplus money on whatever you want.
Look, ideally, yes. Yeah. But the reality is 99% of people don't do it.
Yeah.
So I can argue with people, do a budget. But for me in my life, I don't have 4 hours to put a budget together.
Yeah.
So just log on to your internet banking, start an automatic savings plan, and it takes 2 minutes.
Sometimes I log on there and see a lot of Nando's purchases. That's the scary part.
Gotta love Portuguese chicken.
Yeah. So just start the regular savings. Yeah. Let the budgeting happen later. Because if you get to the end of the month and you go, oh shit, I spent too much money.
Yeah, you know you're over. Yeah.
You know you're over. So then you're going to adjust when you realize you're over. But you've already got the savings happening. Mm-hmm. So then it's about adjusting your behaviors to fit the savings plan that you put in place.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah? Yep. So you achieve a similar result. Budgets are always great. Budgets are awesome for being proactive and saying, yeah, I am spending lots of money on Nando's. Yep.
And Tammy from My Budget always makes me feel bad when that ad comes up. I'm like... Yeah, I know.
That's a great example of a sales spiel, bringing up people's problems and fears and anxieties to the surface, and then proposing a solution to that problem and making a sale.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's probably an awesome system that works for the people that it works for.
Yeah.
And if it can take that job of budgeting off people's hands or make it easier, great.
Yeah.
Budgets are awesome.
So you're essentially saying start with something and then gradually ratchet it up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then you'll figure out exactly, you know, soon enough if you're over-saving or, you know, trying to put too
that
much more
never
away.
That never
happen. Well, you know, you're putting more away than perhaps what is realistic for your lifestyle. Yeah.
Exactly. So if you, let's say you just give it your best go and you start with $1,000 a month of savings. After 3 months, you're going to see, well, do I have a credit card bill that I can't afford to pay off from my regular transaction account? Yes, I do. Well, you've got $3,000 from the last 3 months of savings, and you can dip into that, pay off your credit card, and then adjust.
Yeah.
And you can say, well, do I want to change my behavior of spending so much on my credit card in future? Or do I change the amount I'm trying to save? Yeah. Is $1,000 a month just too much?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, coming back to the contingency plans, the last thing you need to plan around is unexpected changes to health.
Mm.
If you don't have your health, then maybe you can't do your job, or maybe your partner needs to work less at their job in order to take care of you.
I often say to a lot of clients, Louis, your biggest asset, particularly those who are in the wealth accumulation phase, your biggest asset is not your house, your car, your share portfolio. It's your ability to earn an income.
Mm. Yep. Exactly.
And it's funny, it's the one thing that we don't actually look after most of the time as well. Mm. You know, I find myself always saying, because everyone's got such a rush life, I'll get to the doctors later on. And, you know, we were having this conversation the other day that everyone that said they were going to get a regular health checkup or go and get something seen were too busy to do it.
Yeah,
but yeah, we can go out for a drink after work.
You just reminded me.
It's important.
Mm. You've just given me a great business idea. Of where the doctor's clinics should be located and the times that they should be open.
Yes, well, they're getting smarter at that as well. They're
Why isn't there a doctor next to the pub?
Yeah.
Open the pub at 8 o'clock on a Friday night. Should be right there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that, well, they could do good blood alcohol readings after
they
after
could,
session.
Yes,
I'm not
yes.
sure that's probably the best
but
time.
But why
to
not get your health checked right before you go
or
to the pub?
Or at the pub.
Or at the pub.
Yeah.
Wow.
Have a booth.
Genius. All right. I'm going to patent that idea so no one can steal it.
No one's heard of it.
I think it's out there, Louis.
So, what do we need to do to put these plans in place to protect against these contingencies that might happen? Well, for interest rates, if they change, well, you need to have that buffer in your ability to service the debts. If there are things that happen in the job, the earnings, the economy, the number of overtime you get or the bonuses you get, well, how can you protect against those things? If you suddenly get a decrease in your pay, well, you need some cash behind you. That's what you need. Mm-hmm. So what we typically say is 6 months of your expenses is a good amount of available cash to have.
Yeah.
Now, this is a pretty high bar. For a lot of people, this is maybe 60,000, 70,000. Mm. For some people, it might only be 30,000. Mm. But that's a lot of cash to have set aside.
Yeah.
This is, firstly, a target, not a requirement. Secondly, you just need to have access to that money. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have to have it as
savings.
Cash in your savings account. Mm. So for a lot of people, it sits in their home loan as redraw.
Yeah.
Or it's a line of credit facility that isn't drawn, so you don't pay interest on it, but it is there ready to go. You just need to do a bank transfer from the loan account into your transaction
net.
Account, yeah. and it's your safety net. But you need to plan it ahead of time because once something happens, once a decrease in your pay happens, then you can't get that extra finance. It's too late. So you need to plan ahead for this and have the right finance structure.
Yeah.
What if something happens to your family, which is unexpected in terms of an unexpected child? Well, again, having that 6 months worth of expenses is a pretty nice buffer. Mm. You're not going to suffer an immediate loss of one person's wage. Mm. It's going to be staged and sort of managed over time and government benefits and that sort of thing, but it'll be a good buffer. What if something happens to a person's health? Well, you need to have insurance.
Yeah. Yep.
You got to have life insurance in case a person passes away. You got to have disability insurances in place if a person can't work or has a major illness. Mm. Those are the components that go into proper planning around borrowing. So there's two elements to your plans. If we're going to look at a borrowing strategy where we invest your money and get a lot more return over the long term, then yes, we need to have the investment plan and the borrowing plan, but we also need to have the right contingency plans in place with a regular savings plan and a buffer for interest rates. We need to have a cash buffer and we need to have the right insurances in place.
Awesome. Awesome work.
Definitely got me thinking about my contingency plan now. I know what I'll be doing on my weekend while Joel's at the football.
Having a checkup?
All of those things. Yeah. And having a wine. All right. Well, look, we're going to take another short break and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640. Or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back, everyone. We're now going to throw over to Brett, who's going to talk to us about why bigger cities are a safer bet for properties to invest in than regional areas.
Thanks, Steph. Yeah, so this is an article or a case study I was recently reviewing, and I thought there are a number of lessons to come out of it. So as Steph just said about why bigger cities are a safer bet than smaller cities, and it's not just smaller cities or regional areas. This came out of a case study I read recently on the boom and bust of Darwin. So Darwin's considered a city, but does anyone know how it ranks in terms of population within Australia?
So I know about the population, but it's so transient, I would say that's minimal at some times.
Well, it's only the 17th biggest population base.
17th? Yeah. Wow.
17th.
Wow. 17th. I assumed it was 6 or 7.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we all sort of think that because it's the capital of a state, yeah, so we assume it's a bigger city, but it's well behind a lot of regional towns.
Yeah.
So obviously the biggest ones, of course, we know Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane.
Yep.
And then Perth, Adelaide, Gold Coast, which is a big area. Then Newcastle is 7th.
I love Newcastle.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. And Newcastle's got a population 3 times the size of Darwin.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, several other regional areas in between that and where
got
Darwin
a,
lands.
A beach that you can actually swim in and not get eaten.
Yep. Makes a difference.
But is that why their population is so low?
Maybe they're getting snapped up.
They're getting culled.
You ever read that local newspaper up there? You're going to get eaten by a crocodile.
Yep. Well, they've got awards named after Darwin, don't they?
They do.
But the lessons I took away from this case study weren't just about regional areas versus capital cities, even though there's a lot of reasons why we believe capital cities are a safer bet. But it's also about how closely linked jobs are and major projects to property prices in certain areas too. Ooh. And the case in point, the data that was put forward in this case study, so it says that Darwin has around 85,000 residents and a further 65,000 in the greater Darwin area. And in 2012, it had its peak there are a number of infrastructure and big sort of resource projects that were in place around 2010-11.
Is that like the gas plant?
Yes, yeah. That's the major one. And that caused a spike in property prices up there because it had a lot more jobs on offer. Mm. But the biggest problem was obviously when the opportunity, so I can't recall, it's called the Ichthys gas project, which was developed by INPEX. So it was the largest liquid natural gas project in the world and had 3 major facilities. And to build that facility obviously took a series of years and all of the jobs that came along with that. So that created a lot of demand for people in Darwin to take those jobs, and therefore a lot of population growth, more money. So therefore property prices, supply demand, property prices increase. So in 2016, that project peaked by having 8,000 people employed. But of course, once that project's been delivered and then it goes into maintenance mode, a lot of those staff are no longer required. And if there's no other jobs around, therefore the people can't earn an income, they're going to leave and they're going to go elsewhere. Yeah. And this was the boom-bust cycle of Darwin. And it's a very similar boom-bust cycle that happens in most mining towns.
Yes. Mm.
So when I'm talking about regional areas versus capital cities, I guess I'm more alluding to be careful of the mining towns or the project towns that are going to have a lifespan, because there will be a boom and a bust.
Yeah.
And that's a real risk to be aware of. So there can be good money to be made, but typically if you can't see the life of the jobs or the employment sector that's going to spin off, and if there's going to be more than just the implementation, there's going to be ongoing jobs, chances are there's going to be a bust.
Well, that's funny that you mentioned that, because I was out in Middlemount, which is northern Queensland, in a mining town not that long ago, and that is just sort of a purpose-built setup, because there's coal mining there, and you could just feel that is not long term. You know, once it's, you know,
yep, once it's up and running,
it's run, it's out. But
yep,
incredible salaries coming through there, and what people Huge. Were spending on even for their online shopping was just phenomenal.
Yes.
But you know, the locals were just saying to me, it's sort of not a real world, and they know that the rent that they're paying is so low as well for houses. Right. You know, I think it was like $80 a month for the house that they were actually paying for.
Whoa. Crazy.
Crazy stuff. So you could just feel that that's something that will eventually slide and won't stay forever. So
yeah.
It was real exposure for me to see how that works in a place like that.
Well, and I've seen stories of people, this is more on some of the Perth mining areas, where over time as more and more people were coming there and they were, you know, a lot of people that were going to service these mining towns, as projects were getting off the ground, the companies that owned these mines were paying big dollars because they had timelines and deadlines.
Absolutely.
That they said, we're better off to throw the money at it now and meet our deadlines and make the profit later.
Yeah.
So with those wages being so high, the people moving in there were saying, well, I prefer a better house. So they were buying better properties and the prices just continued to escalate.
Mm.
where you saw properties, and of course the way the values tend to work when you get a mortgage or you buy a property, the valuers look at recent transactions.
Yeah.
So if something sold last week for 600, then 2 weeks later the same sort of property sells for 650 and it continues to escalate.
Up, yeah.
The values continue to support that it's worth that.
Mm.
But then as soon as that drops out and there's no longer that demand, the values can drop very quickly as well. And I've heard stories of people that have bought, you know, more than one property in some of these areas at those, say, $600,000 or $700,000, and then can't even find a buyer at $200,000 and $300,000.
Oh, really?
So they lose everything because quite often they've maybe leveraged out of their existing home and anything else. So it all sounds good because you've seen a property go from 400 to 500 to 600 and you think, get on board.
Yeah.
But once the downturn comes, if the you know, if the population's exiting and the money's no longer there, unfortunately, there's going to be some serious pain.
Well, we had some friends in Darwin. I think we would have been up there around 2012 when that was at the peak.
They were very lucky to get out.
Yeah.
They were very
they
bought
sold
in
at the peak as well. You know, pretty much.
Yeah.
But it was still actually hard work for them to sell that house off, but they got out right at the most opportune time to exit the market.
The challenge is because there can be some really nice houses, but there just isn't a buyer. No one wants to live there. There's nothing there for them.
Lots
if there's no job, and, you know, you pop that same dwelling, that building, anywhere else in a capital city, you'll always find a buyer.
Yep.
But unfortunately, these areas... and look, the case in point with Darwin too, after the large boom, so the median price increased by over $100,000 in 2 years, but as of now, prices are actually below their 2011 levels.
Wow.
Wow. Right.
Mm. So that's where I'm saying be mindful. And what we've sort of suggested earlier today about the biggest capital cities. So when we do our buyer's agency work for investors and we actually identify the areas, we do typically look at Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane as the major markets we look at. And then we'll look at regional areas outside of that as well. But typically our regional areas aren't solely focused on the resource sector or one industry or project. So areas, like we said before, Newcastle has enough infrastructure, enough stability there that it's got its own ability to survive more than one
Newcastle
business
to,
going
area.
Broke.
I think it's actually really come leaps and bounds in you know, the last 10 years. So.
It's got a lot of lifestyle things.
It's close to the beach. I don't know if you
and
you
nice
know,
beaches,
have been up there,
beautiful
but it's,
beaches.
It is stunning.
Yep.
It really is. It's
and
gorgeous.
You've got those other assets nearby like Nelson's Bay, Hunter Valley.
Mm.
Yeah.
A lot of reasons why Newcastle can be a place to live.
Public transport system. I mean, we looked at it. It was new stations up there when we were up there not that long ago.
From Newcastle to Sydney and the like.
Yep. And look, the other regional areas that I think still make a lot of sense too are the ones that are still a reasonable commute to a major capital city. So obviously in Victoria, we've got the likes of Ballarat, Bendigo, Geelong.
It's too cold.
Well, yeah, by comparison, but there's still a sound basis for owning property there because even though, you know, they're still a small population base by comparison, a lot of the people there can commute and get jobs in the bigger
that
capital.
Is true. Yeah.
So that's okay, and we're comfortable to look at properties in those areas. We still prefer capital cities because there's always going to be more demand and more people wanting to live there. But sometimes price points and what you're trying to afford, the regionals can be okay, but it's the mining or areas that are solely focused on one industry or one project that's driving the values, that's going to be the problem.
Yeah.
And I think, so just be mindful. Anyone that's being spruced because of the growth, have a look at the overall timeline horizon. Like even if they say this project's going to last for 10 or 15 years, you're almost not doing your due diligence on the property. You're doing your due diligence on the project or the company that's employing everyone because that's what's driving your property growth.
Yeah, you're looking for sustainable growth drivers, not short-term growth drivers.
Correct.
Can I just ask one question before we finish up, though? If I was a property investor and I was going to buy into an area like Middlemount and purchase the property and had a short-term goal of making my money on that property and getting out, is that some kind of a strategy you would use or not?
Look, I personally wouldn't recommend that as a strategy because of the risk associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the challenge is even if you do have a short-term time frame, which might only be 2 to 3 years, okay, the two biggest problems with that I see, the first one is your transaction costs are going to eat into whatever returns you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to pay stamp duty and you're going to have to pay all the legals and transaction and selling costs. So whatever return you could make, if it's good enough, you're still going to lose a portion of it. The other part is you're trying to speculate on the timing of that. And if you get it wrong, unfortunately, you've lost.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the risks outweigh the potential rewards there.
Yeah. And the risk is that you're not selling just below the price. You might not be able to sell.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If the market drops and there's no buyers, you're stuck.
In any asset class, when you're trying to make money just by playing the cycle, whether it's shares or property, you're trying to profit from information that everyone has. You've got the same information as everyone else. So when you're a buyer, you've got other buyers that know the same thing. And when you're a seller, you've got other sellers that know the same thing.
Yeah, right.
Whereas what you're trying to do as an investor is look at all of the other factors and make sure those factors are going to work out over time.
Good advice. All right. Well, look, we're going to now throw over to our last topic for the day. It's everyone's favorite. You can't be serious. And who wants to kick off our session for today?
Yeah, I'll kick it off. The hospital system is in Turkey is not getting good press at the moment. A woman has found that she is able to stick a magnet to her skin.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. She had some suspicions after she would walk through the entrance to shops and set off their metal detectors. Yes.
Right.
And then she thought, oh, I had that back surgery a few years ago. I've got a bit of pain there as well. What's going on here? Let's do a little experiment. And she took a magnet and she stuck it near where the pain was. And the magnet will stick to her.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I thought she might have been one of the X-Men.
So she went back to the hospital and they admitted, oh, yeah, we might have left something inside you.
Whoopsie.
Oh, no. No, thank you.
What a mistake.
Yes. Yeah. You cannot be serious. Oops. Well, last week I entered into the topic of marijuana, or Moana, if you remember the way it was referred to, with the magical cake that was made.
Yes.
So down that path on another weed story, a Western Australian man has avoided jail even though he was apprehended with evidence of over 50 plants of marijuana that he was growing. So the reason that the judge didn't punish him appropriately was because they found out that the weed was totally shit and unusable. So in other words, even though he was growing it, it was unsaleable, so therefore it really wasn't for any purpose.
He wasn't going to make any money. Yeah.
Brett, I didn't have one this week, but having your conversation around Darwin, just a little funny story that from the last time I popped up to Darwin with Steph. Northern Territory News, NT News, is famous for its headlines.
I know where he's
going. He's
troublesome guy.
Oh, yes. Let's go.
Adult rated.
The last time we were up there, the headlines wrote, "How Gary Blew It All," and "The World's Biggest Wanker." Gary was a gentleman who had a problem with touching himself.
Oh my goodness.
This is a newspaper that you can buy on the street.
This is a newspaper you can buy on the street, and the headline was right across NT.
Bizarre.
They've always got fabulous headlines up there, though. They do.
Yep.
All right. Well, look, we're going to have to finish up there, but thank you very much for all your input today, guys, and thanks for our listeners for tuning in. Have a fabulous weekend, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.